What is your favorite song? Many of us have strong preferences when it comes to our music choices. We might not agree with others about the best song or album, but one thing is clear for humans. Music is a vital part of our lives. We engage with music through various activities such as attending concerts, creating playlists, and following top music charts. Despite music being a part of our everyday lives, little is known about how humans process it. This is Under the Cortex. I am Özge Gürcanlı Fischerbaum with the Association for Psychological Science. In this episode, I'm joined by Nicholas Katias and Psyche Louis from Northeastern University, as well as Matthew Sachs from Columbia University. They recently published their research findings in APS's flagship journal, Psychological Science. Together, we will discuss how people find new musical sounds rewarding, and we will explore the cognitive mechanisms underlying this phenomenon. Nicholas, Psyche, and Matthew, thank you for joining me today. Welcome to Under the Cortex.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So, Nicholas, Psyche, and Matthew, tell our listeners a little bit about yourselves before we dive into your research.
Hi, everyone. My name is Nick. I am a third-year PhD candidate at Northeastern University studying psychology. I'm really excited to be here.
Hi, I'm Matt. I'm a associate research scientist at Columbia and a data scientist at Spotify, who worked with Psyche as an undergrad at Harvard and also as a postdoc at Columbia, now continuing on.
And I'm Psyche Louis, and I'm Associate Professor of Creativity and Creative Practice in the Department of Music and in Psychology at Northeastern University, where I run the Mind Lab. The Mind Lab stands for Music, Imaging, and Neural Dynamics.
Wonderful. Thanks again for being with us today. How did you get involved with this research?
Well, I've been interested in music and the brain for as long as I can remember. I play music myself. Started as a kind of good Asian kid playing piano and violin, but then also very interested in science and took all the science classes growing up. And at some point in undergraduate days, I started taking courses in neuroscience and really kind of thought that was where it's at. And then when I started reading about music and brain research, that was kind of nascent at the time, I just really kind of fell in love with the field and wanted to do it forever and ever. And I guess I haven't really looked back.
What about you, Nick?
Yeah, so I, like a lot of people in this field, first got familiar with music through my classical training. I played the French horn, and I got really excited about the intersection between music and science when I heard about this field of music therapy. And I knew that most music therapists weren't French horn players. So I became really interested in sort of doing the science that might support music therapy. And that's sort of how I got into majoring in music and psychology at my undergrad. And I was lucky enough to get involved with a lab that was doing music and memory research. And that really set me up for success and interest in applying to grad school. And that's sort of how I got here today.
Mm-hmm. And you, Matt?
Yeah, I also grew up playing music and studying science. My parents are both psychiatrists and musicians, so it kind of made sense to merge these two interests. And in high school, I started reading a bit more about it, particularly authors like Oliver Sacks and their exploration into the intersection between these two mediums. And then luckily, as an undergrad, they offered a course on music and neuroscience, which Psyche was a guest lecturer in. So I met Psyche through that and applied to her lab as a undergrad researcher. And then since then, I've been involved in work with Psyche, but others as well, since undergrad.
Yeah, that was like more than 10 years ago, right?
Yeah, probably 2010, almost 14
wow.
years ago. Yeah,
14 years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, as I understand your paper, you offer a theoretical model about predictability. And you suggest that hearing something a lot of times makes it easier for people to predict what will happen next. And then people like that they can predict. Can you give an example of how this might play out with a song?
Sure, yeah. So in our model, we use this music that people were very unfamiliar with to look at how learning the structure of the music relates to how much people like it. And we showed that the more they hear it, the more repeated times, they are better able to learn the structure and therefore like it. But we sort of know, and we also sort of believe, that this is probably an inverted U, so that if people hear it over and over and over, it becomes too repetitive, liking starts to drop. So music subverting those expectations in the right way is also something we tend to really like. So you can think of songs that maybe have like a deceptive cadence or a borrowed chord, where we expect something like a resolution back to the tonic, but they actually go to a seventh or a second. Those are moments that are not uncommon within the structure of Western music, but not exactly what might be predicted in that moment, given the amount of time we've heard something like a 4-5-1. You could hear this in tons of songs, not just pop, but tons of classical music songs as well. Istan und Trostald is one that comes to mind by Wagner. So I think it's a little bit more complicated than just we like things that we can predict. It's we like things when we are rewarded that we can predict them, but also when those predictions are within a framework that we are likely to be able to know what comes next, but then they subvert those expectations in key ways.
Mm-hmm. So do you think, is this why pop music is so popular? Like, people like how predictable it is?
I think that's one possible way.
Yeah, I mean, I think that most popular music really tends to have a certain chord progression, right? So very few deceptive cadences, per what Matt just said. It also tends to have a groove, or it tends to be in 2-3-4-4-4, right? So those very kind of predictable rhythmic structures. But I think most pop music, and I would say maybe all kind of successful songwriters and producers, are also sensitive to the novelty aspect. So I really like Adele, Someone Like You. That song, that's a mega hit, of course. But there's something about that moment when she sings, "Every time I find someone like you, ooh," right? And then there's the additional ooh, ooh, ooh bits that came right after the you. I think those are moments that are slightly unexpected, and that's when music becomes most rewarding. There are different forces at play that music kind of simultaneously taps into.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this takes me to my next question. So you rely on a music scale unfamiliar to most audiences. This is what it sounds like.
Feels at first like you're in an unfamiliar world, and it's at first kind of odd and maybe a little bit decentering, but then after a while of listening, it really starts to feel not only familiar, but you start to form your own expectations for it. It kind of almost sounds like you're starting to get the hang of a new language, if you will. And this Bolan-Pierce scale, it was initially discovered by two people, Bolan and Pierce, or independently had mathematically worked out how, if you take these mathematical ratios that are predetermined using the 3-to-1 frequency ratio, as opposed to the 2-to-1 frequency ratio, which is in Western music. So what Bolan and Pierce independently found out was that the 3-to-1 frequency ratio can be divided into 13 steps to form this novel musical scale that has steps that are a little bit larger than the Western traditional musical scale, but that still afford real chords and chord progression. So if you play certain notes together, they still sound smooth and they still sound acoustically plausible. So then that became the basis of our new experimental studies. But I should say, our lab's not the only ones that have come up with music in this scale. There's a small and very active field of microtonal and macrotonal music composers that are really into this. And in fact, in the year 2010 at Northeastern University, there was a whole concert series on the Bolan-Pierce scale music where these macrotonal composers from all around the world came together and hosted a series of concerts. And by the end of three nights of listening to these new tuning systems, you really do start to feel like, it becomes very much like something you've been used to all the time, which really, I think, dovetails well with our current findings.
Yeah. Can you walk me through how I, as a participant, would experience your study?
Yeah, so typically when we talk about the setup of our experiment, we talk about it in about three phases. So in the first phase, we expose participants to this new music written in the Bolden-Pierce scale, once per melody, and we ask them how much they like it, how familiar it sounds. Typically, it doesn't sound too familiar to listeners, again, of course, because this is quite a novel musical scale. After that, phase two is the exposure phase. And during this phase, this is when participants are exposed to varying levels of different melodies at different amounts of times. And during this part of the task, we actually tell participants to pay attention for warbles or vibratos in the music. And that's what they think the experiment is about. So detecting these warbles in this sort of novel scale. When in fact, we're actually manipulating how many times they're hearing these stimuli. And really importantly, too, in the exposure phase, the stimuli are all sort of composed on the same chord structure in the Bolden-Pierce scale. So when they finish this exposure phase, they go to the next phase, which is the rating phase, which again, we ask both liking and familiarity, and they're exposed to all these melodies again. And they're also exposed to sort of complementary versions of each melody, which begin the same but end differently. And importantly, this difference sort of violates that chord structure that they all were built on in the exposure phase. And we also sort of present them with two new melodies, one which they haven't heard before, of course, that sort of conforms to this chord structure, and another that is the same from that new one, but ends differently as well. So this allows us to sort of tease apart both the effect of sort of exposure to a single item or melody in the exposure phase, but we're also able to tease apart the effects of exposure to this sort of learned harmony or harmonic structure that's underlying all of the melodies in the exposure phase.
Mm-hmm. And one of the strengths of this paper is that you use a variety of populations to test the boundaries of your hypotheses and how generalizable they are. Can you talk a little bit about how you recruited and why you chose different populations?
Well, I would say the most important question about where music comes from and why we have it is how much is it innate and how much of is it learned, right? So that the classic nature nurture debate, which I think we're really kind of trying to move past that, but trying to look into, you know, gene culture coevolution and kind of that interactions between cultural exposure and properties of the sounds themselves. So one kind of basic question is, do people from different cultures react the same way to these new tunes that they're hearing for the first time? And surprisingly, that hadn't been done before, not with the Bolden-Pierce scale. So at the time, we had a student who was based in Beijing Normal University, Tia Oh. So she got on board and very quickly learned about our research and then ended up running the Beijing portion of the study. So we had a series of studies that were run on online listeners based in the US, and then one study was done in Chinese individuals based out of Beijing, and those results were remarkably similar. And then there were a few other cases that were super interesting. Nick, maybe do you want to talk a little bit about them?
Sure. Sort of another approach we took in this paper was another way to think about why we have music evolutionarily or in our everyday lives is investigating a specific case study of musical anhedonia. And individuals with musical anhedonia experience blunted pleasure specifically to music. So they enjoy things like walking on the beach or eating good food, but don't really get much pleasure from listening to music. I think what is a notable strength of our paper is that we were able to both test our paradigm both in individuals who had this specific musical anhedonia, but we also were able to take the approach of sort of doing like a mini meta-analysis within our study and relate sort of more continuous individual difference measures of how much people like listen to music and relate that to our outcome. So we were able to sort of probe this in sort of a case study approach, but also in sort of a more continuous across our entire study population approach. So that was pretty informative to what we saw.
Mm-hmm. So if you were to boil down your key finding into two easy to understand sentences for our audience, how would you summarize your findings?
Yeah, I can try to do that. So I guess we show that across two distinct cultures, there's multiple levels of prediction and prediction errors that come into play when it comes to generating musical reward. And furthermore, this trajectory between learning a new musical system and musical reward varies based on individual differences of sensitivity to musical reward and maps on to the brain's reward system.
Mm-hmm. So people experience this differently.
There seems to be differences between them, but it isn't clearly defined by culture. It's defined by, at least in this study, something else, which is our individual sensitivity to musical reward. That's related to what Nick was talking about with music anhedonia as an extreme version of that, where there's very, very low sensitivity to musical reward. But cultural differences in terms of the music we listen to and acculturated from birth didn't seem to have a huge play here. So that isn't a clear differentiator here.
Mm-hmm. So this takes me to my next question. So why is it important for us to know this? What are the implications of your findings?
Yeah, I can take a stab at this. This is something I've been wondering a lot about for a long time. You know, folks saying like, I'm not a bluegrass kind of guy, or I'm a classical kind of person, or a jazz kind of person. I mean, are there real mappings between these genres and individual differences in what predictions we find to be rewarding? Or is it much more about identity that we latch onto with certain kind of musical genres having certain stereotypes, right? And, you know, growing up as a music major, we studied a lot of 20th century music that many kind of public audience might think of as not enjoyable, very strange kind of music. Right. And I'd always wondered how much of those tastes are really determined by like actual brain differences or cultural and upbringing differences. And so one part of this work that really, I think, rings true is showing us that, you know, with enough exposure, you can learn to like new music, even though it seems very alien and unfamiliar and strange at first. And then the other part of that is there are individual differences in how sensitive we are to these acoustic experiences and the way they tap into our reward system.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of research are you going to be focusing on next on this topic?
Nick has all sorts of ideas.
So we're particularly interested in looking at what's going on with music reward valuation earlier in development. So I'm thinking more in terms of childhood and adolescence. And this is particularly inspired by, I would say, two sort of separate lines of literature. The first in older adults, which shows that older adults tend to recall most autobiographical memories in response to music from around their adolescent or teenage years. Typically, these memories are associated with greater preference for music from this time period. So that's sort of one piece of evidence that there's something important going on with how people interact with music in this developmental window. And at the same time, work in sort of the developmental cognitive neuroscience sphere has shown that the adolescent brain is sort of optimized to use reward to learn quite well. So that's sort of some more evidence in development that there's also something going on with reward valuation. And given that this study is sort of interested in thinking about how musical reward is sort of built up through exposure, we're interested in seeing if this might be particularly strengthened in adolescence, which might sort of explain sort of lifelong affection towards music from this time period.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that you all are engaging with music in different ways, but what is it like to collaborate with musicians in psychological research? So that is not a very common experience for most psychologists. What was it like?
Yeah, so to clarify, for this project, most of the music was written by somebody in Psychus Lab who is a researcher and a musician. And a lot of times, because of our backgrounds, we can get away with writing our own or using our own resources to come up with stimuli. But sometimes, and a lot of times, it might make sense to not do that and actually work directly with people who are so adept at doing this. So for some research I did at Columbia, we collaborated with film composers at NYU's Film Composition School. And the idea is we wanted music that was going to induce a particular emotion at a particular period of time. And film composers are actually naturally trained to do this. This is exactly what a director might ask from them too. So it was actually a very fun collaboration both for me and them, because I think maybe more so than other composers, they were used to somebody coming in and saying, we need this feeling right now for this long with these instruments. And they went, okay. And then they wrote it. And we kind of went back and forth a little bit on, you know, this maybe is too fast or this didn't really convey it, and trying to kind of feed data back into what they were doing. So we would take samples, run it through a little survey, see how people responded, give it back to them, they would adjust. And that's how we came up with pieces of music together.
These stimuli were composed by Yuan Zhang, who was an author on the study. Having music technology and music students being in the lab has been really helpful for us. And at Northeastern University, we have this combined major in psychology and music that's pretty unique. So a lot of students come here specifically wanting to think about these kinds of questions. And they also develop music technology and composition skills in the process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you all. So this was very interesting and I personally learned a lot. If our listeners want to learn more about your work, where might they read more and or follow you?
I guess X is the new Twitter, right? I'm at Psyche Louis. I'm the only Psyche Louis on the internet, as far as I know, so I'm very easy to find on Google.
I don't have X, but you can go to MatthewSachs.com.
I'm also periodically on X, so you can follow me at Nick Kathios, NickKathios.
Oh, yes. Also, Blue Sky. I think and I are both on Blue Sky. I'm actually on there more than I am on X now.
All right. So we have your names, and I hope your listeners will do a Google search, and they will find you on X or Blue Sky or on your website, Matt. This is Özge Gürcanlı Fischerbaum with APS, and I have been speaking to Nicholas Katias and Psyche Louis from Northeastern University and Matthew Sachs from Columbia University. If you want to know more about this research, visit psychologicalscience.org.
Under the Cortex is brought to you by the APS Annual Convention. APS 2024 is the premier global event in psychological science, featuring content from all areas of the field, including industrial, organizational, developmental, cognitive, social, and more. It's being held in San Francisco, California, May 23rd through the 26th, and it's an event you won't want to miss. For more information about registration, visit APS2024.org.